This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
We were upset. We wanted to deal with it. Uh-huh. I went back to Peter, who was a teacher at American University, and I was doing a class there with him. And I, afterward, we talked, and I was curious about the atomic bomb and how that got really started. And he told me his amazing story about how that began, it was leading back to Vice President Henry Wallace in the 1944 convention, and how that tied in. And I thought about all, thought that would make a great documentary or a film, and it started there, the atomic bomb.
That was back in 1996.
That's right. Well, okay, you know, I might say that this book and the series starts a few years before 1900 with the Spanish-American War and the Philippines and all that, and it continues right up to Obama's term, so it covers about 115 years of history.
Yeah, we're still back in the Philippines, by the way.
You know, we are. Yes, we are. Well, it goes through World War I, World War II, the Depression, the Cold War, and all that. Why don't we talk about the bomb and Henry Wallace? A lot of people probably don't even know who Henry Wallace was.
Okay, Peter, you do the short version.
Henry Wallace has unfortunately been lost to history, at least up until our book and documentaries came out. Wallace was a visionary Secretary of Agriculture in the 1930s. And when Roosevelt was going to run for a third term in 1940, he wanted a real progressive on the ticket and an anti-fascist because he knew we were heading toward war in the near future against fascism and Japanese militarism. And so he insisted on Wallace on the ticket. And Wallace got the nomination after a struggle. And as vice president, he continued with his progressive policies. In 1942, he made a very important speech, which he repudiated the idea that the 20th century should be the American century and said it must be the century of the common man. He called for a worldwide people's revolution. And he was a visionary. He was anti-colonialism, against imperialism, and openly critical of Wall Street, pro-labor, pro-civil rights for African Americans. But in 1944, the party bosses, who were much more conservative, realized that Roosevelt was weakening and was not going to last another term. And so they determined to get Wallace off the ticket and replace him with Harry Truman. But their plans were almost derailed. Wallace was enormously popular. When the Democratic Party convention began July 20th, 1944, Gallup released a poll asking potential voters who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% said they wanted Henry Wallace back as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. At the convention that first night, Wallace made a seconding speech for Roosevelt. The place went wild with a spontaneous demonstration. And in the midst of that, in 45 minutes it went on, in the midst of that, Claude Pepper, the senator from Florida, knew that if he could get to the microphone and put Wallace's name in nomination, they would defy the bosses. Wallace would sweep the convention, be back on the ticket as vice president. To make a long story short, Pepper got within 5 feet of the microphone before they forced the meeting to adjourn. Had Pepper gotten 5 more feet and nominated Wallace, and Wallace become president on April 12, 1945, instead of Harry Truman, Oliver and I are convinced that there would have been no atomic bombings in August of 1945, as we very possibly could have averted the Cold War entirely.
That's really amazing. This is something I have never heard about.
No, unfortunately, most Americans don't know this part of our history. There's a lot of our history that Americans don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Oliver and I decided we needed to do this project.
Well, I know that that they dumped Wallace, but I wasn't aware of how close it came. So
9 seconds.
Oh my! So let's get into the Cold War. How did tell us how this led into the beginning of the Cold War?
Well. The Cold War begins during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of it, the Russians are our greatest allies. They take the most damage and they defeat the German army, and we show that in the documentary. We come in on the tail end of the war to them, And by the end of the war, when Roosevelt has died, and now Harry Truman has succeeded him as president, and Truman is a different kind of individual than Roosevelt. He is, doesn't see the big picture. He sees the Russians, the Soviets, as antagonists during the war. And at Potsdam, they're dividing up the world, and Truman gets news of the Alamogordo test, and it's working, the bomb is working, and he decides shortly thereafter to drop it on Japan. But really, as we try to argue in our and show that Japan is prostrate, they're done. They're completely exhausted, and the Russians, by agreement with Roosevelt, are coming into the eastern sector. They have attacked Manchuria, and they're moving towards the Japanese islands. They've wiped out an entire Japanese army. They're more than enough for the Japanese to handle. They're terrified of the Soviets. Truman knows all this. He knows the Japanese are on their knees, and he decides anyway to go ahead and bomb Japan. We argue that this is basically a barbaric show of force that wasn't necessary, but to show the Soviet Union that the United States was going to be the kingpin, was going to be the dominant force in the world after the war.
Leslie Groves, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, Brigadier General Groves, says that in his mind, from the very beginning of the Manhattan Project, he was conducting it as if Russia was the enemy, not Japan.
Mm-hmm. It was not just one bomb, it was two.
Well, that's because we had two different kinds of bombs. We had a uranium bomb,
oh,
which we dropped on Hiroshima.
Uh-huh.
We had a plutonium bomb, which we dropped on Nagasaki.
It's interesting about the Cold War. You know, William Mandel told me that actually there's some kind of a Cold War medal at the Pentagon made, and they have the Cold War beginning in 1945, which is much sooner than most people think
right.
of it.
Right. If you drop a bomb on a country that doesn't have to be bombed,
mm-hmm.
and the Soviets are living up to their portion, their treaties with us, and they had promised to do this, how would you take it? The message is kind of clear that the United States is not going to deal with you as an ally.
That was the message that Stalin got, and the generals got, and the scientists got immediately. Because the Soviets knew better than anybody how desperate the Japanese were, because the Japanese in May had embarked on a policy of trying to get the Soviets to negotiate on their behalf to get better surrender terms.
Mm-hmm.
So the Soviets had told the United States that the Japanese had approached them, that the Japanese were trying to basically surrender, which we knew anyway. We'd been intercepting their cables. Truman refers to the intercepted July 18th cable as the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. This was not a secret. Everybody knew the Japanese were on their last legs at that point, but would hold out if they thought that the United States was going to assassinate the emperor, basically. So we knew how to end the war. We chose not to, in part because we actually wanted to drop that bomb and those two bombs, because we wanted to send a message to the Soviets. We wanted to show how ruthless we were, and if we were going to, they got the message, if we were going to drop this on the Japanese, who were in the process of trying to end the war, then what would we do to the Soviets if they interfered with our plans for Europe and Asia?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's one very important thing, well, a whole lot of important things in this book. The one that really struck me is because I keep telling people about it was this memo from George Kennan back in the late 40s. Now, he was this foreign policy guru at the State Department. Basically, he said, I think it was a presidential position paper or something, that we have 6% of the world's population and we have 50% of the world's wealth, and we want to keep it that way.
Very important 1948 statement, which basically lays out what was going on in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
If you dig beneath all of the rhetoric about freedom and democracy and our attempts to basically improve the world, you dig down beneath it, what we were motivated in part by, at least, was this idea that we were economically so dominant at that point and militarily so dominant. How were we going to retain our dominance in a hungry world, in a world that wanted to end colonialism, in a world where other people were striving for dignity also? And our strategy was to spread a certain kind of benevolent rhetoric, but behind that, in a very forceful way, by remilitarizing and spreading this around the world, we were going to enforce American interests, at least that narrow conception of American interests, meaning that America should retain a disproportionate amount of the world's wealth.
And that really hasn't changed, because one of the issues at this climate conference recently was that the U.S., that we per capita use up, we have a bigger carbon footprint than anyone else in the world.
Yes. There's hope in the story, too, but it's very hard to change your behavior when you get used to certain things. And our generation, since the 1940s, we've had it our way. The bomb certainly gave us the sense of doing, we knew we were the most powerful country in the world, and at the same time, we confused that with the sense that we were right because we were the most powerful country. And I think we got lost. Our identity's been lost. We kind of suffer from a sense of delusion or hypnosis, if you want to call it, where, you know, what we do is correct around the world. And as a result, we've been involved in numerous wars, which more often than not, we've instigated.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why Henry Wallace is so important, because even after he gets dumped from the ticket in 1944, he stays on as Secretary of Commerce. And from that position inside the cabinet, he's the one person who's capable of seeing the world, not just from the American standpoint, but he also understands it from the standpoint of the Soviet Union. He understands it from the standpoint of Latin American countries. And so he takes a different perspective than Truman has. Truman was not a bad guy. Truman was just very parochial. He was a small-town Missouri guy who surrounded himself with small-town Missouri advisors for the most part, although some like Burns came from South Carolina, and they just had a very, very narrow view. What we need now, is to see the world from a much broader perspective. We're a planet of 6 billion people. I mean, it's a small planet. We should be viewing things from the standpoint of all of our interests, whether that comes to the climate change or your allocation of resources. It's the same common interest that we share.
Okay, this is KBOO, Fight the Empire, and my two guests are film director Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick, who have collaborated on a TV series and a 700-page book, The Untold History of the United States. You know, there's so much in here that it's fascinating reading. It's a terrific reference book.
Yeah.
What if we skip forward to the end of the Cold War?
Great moment, yeah, 1989, when Bush comes into office. He was vice president, he becomes president when he beats Dukakis. And Gorbachev, the Soviet premier, is offering a great deal. The biggest olive branch has been offered since the 1940s. And Bush, instead of taking an open view on it, applauds Gorbachev for leaving, taking his troops out of Eastern Europe, allowing these regimes to fall. And at the same time, he goes into Panama, he invades Panama on the case of a drug war, he calls it. And then he goes into Iraq, in 1991. Less than 2 years later. So the example the United States sets in this new world that's offering peace is two invasions. It's a rather nasty message at that point.
Also, the big issue then was the Warsaw Pact was abandoned, and then the NATO moved right up to the borders of the Soviet Union.
Not right away, but no. under Clinton and the Bush II.
Well, this tells me that the Cold War was really not about evil communism. It was just a sort of a matter of geopolitical positioning.
In many ways, the United States, you know, has retained that sense of needing an enemy in order to justify our bloated defense establishment, our military spending, our empire of bases, 600, 700, 800, 900, maybe 1,000 bases around the world, our 10 or 11 carrier strike groups. I mean, we still patrol the planet. We're still the world's policemen, and we still have retained our empire in the same way after the Cold War that we did during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time changed weaponry and made it. I mean, certainly, we sell. What's amazing to me is we sell, what is it? 78% of the world's arms. But at the same time, we keep designing the most advanced ones we can, so we're almost competing against ourselves rather than the world. I mean, we sold the drone architecture to other countries, and we keep developing better and better drones. We keep developing space. We've militarized space. And we're an outlier in that sense. We're the leader in building new weapons, and then we're the leader in selling them. So, in other words, it ensures that the rest of the world catches up, so we drive on. So there seems to be a giant octopus inside ourselves that needs, like Eisenhower called it, the military-industrial complex. I think you can say it's a global security complex, whether you're selling it to the world, and you create this idea that we need, we can't trust each other, and we need to build our forces up. And not only that, we're going to sell you our latest weaponry so that you can build yourself up. And then we're going to, but we're ahead of you a bit. It's kind of a madhouse.
Kind of a treadmill kind of thing. It's just, yeah. Well, one of the things that is sort of really, a lot of people are confused about is how the Soviet Union fell, how Yeltsin took over. I mean, we yeah. have this image of Yeltsin standing on top of a tank or something like that, yeah. and that's not quite true, is it?
No, I mean, I think it's a sad story that Gorbachev, we see Gorbachev as very much a visionary leader who was trying to guide the Soviet Union to a healthy, sane place where its economy could function. And, of course, there was many people in the U.S. who did not have a rooting interest in that, even though Gorbachev has expressed his peaceful intent repeatedly. So, you know, there was Gorbachev's latest memoir, which hasn't come out in the United States. It's called Alone. And it's about his death of his wife and his whole life. His beautiful story.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes about how he feels that Yeltsin was actively supported by people in the U.S. administration, as he was the Russian Republic president, and he was a hero for a while because he looked great on camera, and he did rescue Gorbachev at a very key time when the communist hardliners had revolted against Gorbachev, and after that his days were numbered. But Yeltsin's intentions were always to break up the Soviet Union into these republics. Now, people don't, you know, to understand that the Soviets is a huge series of nationalities. So what happened is when they all broke up was that there was sort of a definite right-wing revolt against all this. In all these countries, all the feudal baronies became these gigantic countries which were funneling corruption, taking over public resources and privatizing them a la America, Wild West American style. It was a free-for-all.
That's where the oligarchs came from. Well, it is it's 20 minutes after of Oliver Stone. You have to leave now.
I have somebody, but please keep going for a moment. Let's see what the next question is. But it's a great story of the world, the balance and the way the balance of power shifts. But it doesn't ever seem to go in the right direction. It starts to go, and then it sort of veers back to this possessiveness and greed or militarization.
Well, a lot of people aren't aware that Yeltsin dissolved. It was an elected parliament, I believe.
Yes, he did.
And he dissolved it, and he ruled by decree. Uh-huh.
And not only did he do that, he brought in American advisors, people who had already put Poland through what they called shock therapy, and they put the Soviet economy through shock therapy. And what that resulted in was a lowering by almost 90% of the standard of living in the former Soviet Union. Life expectancy dropped by 10 years. It was a nightmare in the Soviet Union by this enforced kind of free market kind of capitalism that they were imposing on the people there. Yeltsin finally gets thrown out, and that's why you get a strong man like Putin in there, because they wanted a nationalist who was going to at least try to represent Soviet interests or Russian interests rather than whatever kind of international monetary interests the Yeltsin regime was fronting for during that time.
Well, my impression is that, you know, that Putin, he stopped Yeltsin from giving away the store.
They had some good luck also because oil prices went up during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Gave them a chance to bounce back. Their military was badly degraded. Their early warning satellite systems were not functioning. They were really becoming a basket case. The standard of living, I think, reached their economy fell to the level of Holland's. So this was once such a powerful, proud nation. which is part of the reason why there's been such a resurgence of support for even Stalin in Russia.
That's for sure. And, you know, the U.S., as you said earlier, has put bases all around, not everywhere quite, but on the doorstep of Russia, as well as the China policy, which is not to be ignored. That's what's going on. It's been going on for a few years, two, three, 4 years now, but definitely we have cast our glance on China as a new threat.
So what do you think the ultimate aim is? Do you think that we could actually take over this Asian heartland somehow, or... It kind of boggles the mind.
They're announcing its containment. That's what Hillary Clinton called it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have bases, and we've put much more. We have a huge presence in Korea, as well as in Japan. Above all, we have how many bases in Japan, Peter?
Oh, dozens. 300. Okinawa alone, and they're shifting now from Futenma to Hinoko. The population is up in arms against that. They've been protesting for years. Obama refused to even pay heed to the will of the Okinawan people and force the Hatoyama government to back down, which led to the collapse of the Hatoyama government. Now we've got, partly as a result of that, Shinzo Abe and an extreme right-wing administration in power in Japan who want to do with Article 9, do away with the peace constitution in Japan. It's a very unsettling situation. We also had a right-wing victory recently in South Korea. That region is moving in a very unfortunate way. The United States is encouraging this. We have arms sales, arms deals with almost all of the different countries.
Yeah, we sold $12 billion in arms to Taiwan in 2010 and 11. Those two years, that infuriated the Chinese. And you know, it's strange. It's the same. It's a repetition of 1940s again. The Truman policy in Russia against Russia,
which George Kennan was the author of, who you mentioned before.
Well, things haven't changed much.
He wrote that dumb telegram.
The telegram wasn't as bad as his foreign policy magazine article, foreign affairs article, the X article.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
Does Japan really think it can match China as far as, China's economy seems to be pretty strong, and Japanese economy has been in the doldrums now for 20 years. What do they think they can do?
China is booming relative to most of the countries, and Japan has been stagnant. But Abe wants to take money out of development, which the Japanese, of course, need, and put it into expanding his defense budget again, which the Japanese had shied away from for some time. Okinawa is very important for the United States if we're going to have this policy of trying to contain China. Okinawa was supposed to be there. The bases in Okinawa were supposed to be there for the United States to protect Japan. Instead, that's where we send our troops out to Afghanistan. We send our troops to Iraq. It's got nothing to do with the defense of Japan as it initially was supposed to.
Well, one thing I keep wondering, if the U.S. keeps kind of poking and prodding China, at what point does China just kind of get fed up and dump the dollar or something like that? Is that in the cards at all?
There's certainly a risk. I mean, it's crazy for the United States to be provoking its creditor in that way. It makes no sense. The policy, hopefully, let's add a bit of optimism here. Obama is showing some signs of waking up from this imperial funk that he's been caught in. He's done some good things lately. The nominating Kerry and Chuck Hagel, the Secretaries of State and Defense, is a major step in the right direction. And these mutterings coming out of the White House lately that we might consider leaving no troops in Afghanistan would be an enormous step in the right direction. So there seem to be some signs that Obama is starting to get it. We've seen other presidents in the past make that kind of change while in office. Our favorite example, of course, is John Kennedy after the Cuban Missile Crisis. But Lincoln also made tremendous strides in a progressive direction. We've got a lot of presidents who've gone the other way, become more conservative in office. But there are examples of people who have gone the right direction, and it's not totally inconceivable that Obama in a second term could follow that course.
Well, I don't know. During the election, of course, here Oregon is a pretty safe state for Obama, so it's voting for third party is not going to damage the Democrats at all. But I think a lot of people thought that a vote for Obama is a vote against Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm. But appointing Hagel is a strong vote against Netanyahu.
Do you think Hagel will get in?
I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic that he will. I think the Democrats will stand with Obama on this, and enough of the Republicans will be willing to support their former colleague.
Perl, I'm going to leave you now.
Well, I think...
It sounds more positive, and we're hopeful for the second term to move in a more liberal direction.
Well, that's good. Thank you very much, Oliver Stone, for being with us. And we're about at the end of the program anyway. We've been talking with Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick about their combined book, The Untold History of the United States, at a 10-part TV series on the Showtime channel, I believe. And so I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, and we're hoping to get out to Portland in April. So we'll let you know when we're going to be there.
Well, that'll be really great. We are really looking forward to that. Once again, we've been talking with Oliver Stone, the filmmaker who is directed Platoon, Wall Street, JFK, a whole bunch of movies, and Peter Kuznick, who's a professor of history at American University, and on this combined project that's been 5 years in the making. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And so this is KBOO. Stay tuned for what's coming up next on your radio station.
And good morning from KBOO, a couple minutes before 10 o'clock. And coming up on your Thursday morning at 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein speaks with Bill Meinst of the American Indian Movement about the battle for indigenous rights, and with activist Barbara Lubin about the ongoing deadly attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. At 11 on Between the Covers, we hear an interview with fiction writer Tony Bisson about his new novel Any Day Now, his life and his work. At 11:30, Andrew Weymouth hosts another edition of 100 Tacks, exploring the area that was Rock Island Clubhouse, a popular attraction for the elite of Portland in the early 1900s. And we hear an excerpt from the recent talk by Sut Jolly on the Left Media. Thanks, KBOO listeners, and thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and coming up next at 10, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, and that's coming right up.
KBOO Radio is proud to help sponsor the Skanner Foundation's 27th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast, Monday, January 21st at 8:30 a.m. This year, the breakfast and ceremony will be held at the Hilton Hotel's Grand Ballroom, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue in downtown Portland. This year's keynote speaker will be Dr. Irma McLaren, poet, anthropologist, and author, who will speak about Dr. King's legacy in the digital age. This breakfast also raises scholarship money for local high school students who are seeking higher education. Again, that's Monday, January 21st. 8:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at the Hilton Hotel's Grand Ballroom, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue. More information can be found at kboo.fm/scannerbreakfast2013.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, January 17th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Once again today, Gabir Abbas is going to join us. The lead attorney with the Council on American Islamic Relations is here to talk with us about the architecture of entrapment and the Muslim community. This, of course, in regard to the Mohammed trial is ongoing. It has been literally made a mockery of. It's been turned into a cheap sideshow by newspapers of record. And Amber Energy, the coal giant, has been joining forces with Peabody Exploration, have launched a full